was the one of the cameras
wait a second.
Distributed before, and it would be nice if I got a I must say I haven't tried because I've been to whether you think I would need instruction or not, or
I mean it's fairly easy to pick up once you've done a few images, and we've even got something even cooler for you to use. As we've got our stuff up and running pretty much, so you can upload images to analyze them instantly. So it might be quite cool for you to test once we've got it secure. I think the actual use of the camera is not too difficult. I think it just takes a little bit of practice.
Okay, so do you think I should ask you for help and schedule something, or just try
that.
Myself?
That'd be good. I've got other things I want to talk to you about as well. So let's do that. Let's just get something in the diary.
Okay, we'll do that by email. Okay.
Hey, I'm just marking off names here. Charnis, Cristiano, Johan, Sarah, Tatiana, Leah, Tina, John Hannigan, Sarah Jo Nixon. It's 10 o'clock. I'll give them 1 minute.
Ed, I know John is traveling to another part of Michigan today. He said he was going to try to be on, but he wasn't sure about his connectivity.
Okay. And I've already announced to some people, but my hot water heater broke yesterday, and the plumber is coming sometime this morning. So I may have to jump off, but I will listen to the recorded call later and try to limit how long I'm off the call for. But I got to get hot water. It's just not acceptable. So, all right. Well, Charnis, Cristiano, Johan, Sarah, Tatiana, I know Leah's here, Tina, and Hannigan, Sarah Jo. Sarah Jo spends her life on Zoom. She's not here.
We all spend our life on Zoom.
She has an existing conflict on the third Wednesday for her IRB.
Okay. All righty. There are going to be some announcements, but I wanted to start in with the presentation today. This is Dr. Jessica Baumier, who's at UCSD in psychiatry. And she's going to give us a talk on executive functioning training to address cognitive and emotional dysfunction. One of our 20-minute talks from someone outside of CFAST, and she's a research scientist in the Center for Excellence for Stress and Mental Health, and she works in the Stress and Neuroimaging Lab with Dr. Alan Simmons, and in the Cognitive Rehabilitation Clinic for Traumatic Brain Injury with Dr. Amy Jack. She got her PhD in the Joint Doctoral Program here at SDSU UCSD, and then was a pre-doc intern at the VA Sepulveda Ambulatory Care Center, and did a postdoctoral fellow at UCSD with Ariel Lang and Murray Stein. She's primarily interested in PTSD, but all aspects of cognitive functioning and involving novel interventions to assess or to treat these cognitive dysfunctions. So, I will turn it over to you, Jessica, if you're ready to go.
Great, thank you. So I know my audio is being a little strange, so if folks can't hear me, please just let me know and go from there.
Yeah, maybe people mute themselves, it'll help.
All right, so thank you very much for the invitation to come out and to present some of my work. So as you mentioned, I'll be talking about executive functioning training as a novel therapeutic approach. Let's see. Okay, so when we think about executive functioning, I think the most obvious things we think about are thinking skills, neuropsychological functioning, so the ability to problem solve, plan, et cetera. And of course, the impact that those thinking skills have on people's daily functioning. So for example, school or work achievement and activities of daily living. But what made me most interested in executive functioning is not so much those cold cognitive skills, but hot cognitive skills. So the ability to use those cognitive skills in the context of emotional information. So as a clinical psychologist interested in intervention for anxiety and PTSD, this was what really intrigued me about this, because we see that there's these links between executive functioning and stress regulation. So potentially in terms of how much exposure people have to stress, but also how reactive people are to those stressors and then how quickly they're able to recover. We also see links between executive functioning and the ability to self-regulate. And that can include things like emotion regulation. So the ability to use reappraisal, for example, and also the ability to down-regulate impulses or not act on impulses when they arise. And particularly relevant for the internalizing spectrum, we see links between executive functioning skills and the ability to down-regulate negative thinking, particularly things like worry, rumination, re-experiencing symptoms in the case of PTSD. We see this link with difficulty regulating cognitions more broadly, applying to difficulty regulating these negative cognitive patterns. So this is what got me interested in the idea that perhaps we can use training techniques as a way to bolster executive functioning, and that might have some downstream benefits for people who have psychopathology.
Jessica, I'm sorry to interrupt. Is everyone else getting a lot of feedback, or is it just me?
There is some. The sound.
Very bad noise.
Jessica, I'm wondering if you have the volume. I'm wondering if you're connected via the computer and your mic. It's really it sounds like you're on an airplane.
Okay. Give me 1 second.
Maybe try just doing through your computer and not through your headset. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, I'm sorry that you can't hear very well.
The headset's probably connected to the computer audio. So.
It is, but it has sometimes been a little weird. How is that?
Say something.
It's better. I can't hear you all now. Hold on. Try that again. Can everybody hear me okay?
It's the same for me.
Okay.
All right, we'll just deal with it.
I could just call in. That might be better if I mute myself on my my computer and call in. Would that be
fine right now on my side?
That's okay to me.
All right, just go ahead.
Sorry about that.
Not that bad.
Alrighty. So based on this, I got interested in the idea that perhaps we could do some training. Basically, we might be able to help people with these executive functioning skills as an intervention strategy. And so there's really two, I guess, methods or approaches that might be helpful in this regard. The first is a compensatory approach. So if you imagine this is a road that's not functional, one option is to take an alternate route. So basically teaching people skills, knowing that there's a particular deficit or problem, teaching them skills that can help them get around it. So one example of this that we use is something called CogSmart. So this is a manualized protocol for cognitive rehabilitation that we use in our cog rehab clinic for things like TBI, facility conditions. So that's one kind of route that you could potentially take. An alternative approach though is to try to take a restorative approach. So that's the idea that maybe we can actually fix the road and still take the same route, sort of harnessing plasticity mechanisms to do that. And one method that's been used to do that is cognitive bias modification. So that's specifically for managing negative information. We can potentially help people practice implicit skills that change their attention or change some of these biases that they have toward negative cues. But what I think is perhaps most of interest to the group today is executive functioning training, which we've adapted to be called cognitive enhancement training, or COGEN. So on the right-hand side, this is an example trial, and I'll walk you through the This is a cognitive bias modification where we're using negative stimuli. And this is our executive functioning training, which is not so much focused on managing negative information, although we think that might be a downstream byproduct, but just using basic thinking skills. The framework that we've adapted to do this cogent program is based on a working memory capacity task and specifically a complex span task. And I'll talk in just a minute about why I think that's a good place to start. But the idea of our training is that we have people go through computer administered practice with specific thinking skills to basically exercise a muscle. So if you think about our cognitive skills as a muscle, by having people repeatedly engage with practice that's appropriately we can create cognitive change based on that experience dependent learning. So I'll show you an example of a particular trial that a person might see if they went through this kind of cognitive training. So the instructions are going to be that we want you to remember specific stimuli, which in this case are words, while you're simultaneously doing a secondary processing task, which is going to be to decide if the sentences presented make sense or not. So you'd be asked to remember add, and then you would see Jane walked her dog in the park. And then the next, then you would decide on that. So does it make sense or not? And then the next word to remember. And then the next sentence, Bob got in his pen and drove away, which we would say, no, that doesn't make sense. Then you see a recall screen where you're asked to remember which items you saw and in what order. So this is a span set size of 2. It's relatively straightforward, but we can adapt this to be more and more challenging based on the kinds of stimuli that we put in and how many. So we sometimes test people up to a set size of 7, which is pretty hard. As I mentioned, we use this complex span task framework. And the reason that I think this is a really nice, suitable paradigm for training is that there's a bunch of different ways you can do this. They all share a commonality of showing people a particular stimuli, having a distractor or processing task that prevents rehearsal, and then a recall component at the end. But you can mix this up in various ways. And so these are some examples of other modifications of the span task that have been done. So we can use mathematical equations as part of the task. We can make it visuospatial if there's issues with verbal learning or memory. You can actually make this so that people are recognizing patterns and remembering locations in the grid or rotations. So there's lots of different formats that can be used. From a training perspective, we can try to train in different formats or different ways within this task. So one is that we can just try to vary the number of items. So we can try to help people get better at how many things they can hold in their working memory at any given time. We can also vary the kinds of cues that are inside the task to have emotional valence, which can be particularly relevant for people with psychopathology who may have difficulty downregulating or ignoring emotional cues. And so this is another approach that's been done in PTSD, is to actually incorporate negative stimuli so that people are manipulating that kind of cue. In our case, we've been most interested in varying how much proactive interference is built into the task. And the reason for that is that there's prior literature suggesting that difficulty with proactive interference might be what's driving some of the repetitive negative thinking that we see in psychopathology. So that's really been currently our target and how we've attempted to do this kind of training. And I can talk at the end if there's time about the specifics of how we've adapted the task, but in brief, we're just basically trying to get people to get better at working with similar stimuli. So we've tested variations of this kind of cognitive training in a couple of ways. We've done it in a brief laboratory format with healthy individuals and really just trying to figure out, okay, if we're able to shift cognition, does that help people get better at regulating negative personal thoughts and memories? And we found that it does seem to. So even after a single session of training, people who go through the training as compared to a sham seem to do better at being able to self-regulate negative thinking. So then we adapted this to be more of an intervention format, because we were interested in whether this is something that would be applicable and helpful to people who have clinical levels of recurrent negative thinking. So we gave individuals with post-traumatic stress disorder a 4-week program where they did this task multiple times a week. And we looked to see whether that was helpful in reducing the characteristic repetitive negative thought in PTSD, which is re-experiencing symptoms, thinking about their trauma a lot. And what we found is that over the course of doing the Cogent program as compared to sham, people in the active program had a significant reduction in their clinical symptoms over time. And in both cases, both in the single session and in the multi-session intervention version, we saw improvements in cognition that seemed to generalize at least a little bit beyond the training task. So when we gave them a novel task with different stimuli, we saw that there were improvements in their cognitive functioning. More recently, we've also looked at how this might be, what the neural substrates of this might be in the brain. So we have adapted the task or a version of the task to be used in the scanner so that we can try to understand what parts of the brain are recruited most when people are engaged in more difficult trials. And again, in this case, difficulty is indexed by how much proactive interference is built into the task. And as you might expect, we see that areas of the brain that are responsive to difficulty in that way are included in part of the frontal parietal circuit. So we see increases in dorsolateral functioning as well as the anterior cingulate when people are trying to engage in this kind of task. We've also done a very small study where we looked at changes over the course of doing this as an actual intervention. So we recruited individuals with PTSD and scanned them before and after they went through Cogent cognitive training, and saw that there was increased activation in lateral prefrontal and prefrontal cortex, and also the cingulate into the medial prefrontal cortex. So small study, but suggests that there's some potential movement there over the course of doing the training as an intervention in individuals with psychopathology. So in terms of what we're doing now with this, we're trying to replicate these initial findings of this training as an intervention modality, and trying to understand what the neural mechanisms of that might be in a sample of veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder. And so we're having people come in and do an extensive battery of clinical assessments and cognitive assessments, as well as a scan before and after they go through a Cogent or a comparator condition. I'm really trying to understand how this impacts symptoms. So is there clinical efficacy there? But also how this is changing neural functioning, both in the context of general executive functioning, so what I'll call cold cognitive processing, no emotional information, just how they're able to perform on neuropsychological tests, and also how they're able to function during affectively hot cognitive tasks, so when they're trying to engage in reappraisal. So we're interested in looking at this both in our PTSD sample, but we're also interested in trying to expand this out into other populations that may have executive functioning deficits or who may benefit from this kind of cognitive training. We currently have a study ongoing where we're testing this training format in individuals who have social anxiety disorder, and we're testing it actually as an adjunctive to an exposure-based paradigm. So typically what we would do in the course of treatment, we do cognitive behavioral therapy with exposure. So we're combining these things together to try to understand whether cognitive training with the CBT variation can improve outcomes and how that looks in the brain as well. We're scanning people in that. We have a current R61 that's under review where we're also looking to expand this and apply it more broadly to individuals across the internalizing spectrum. So we're planning to recruit individuals with anxiety, depression, traumatic stress disorders, all of whom seem to have a common clinical problem of these repetitive negative thoughts, and also some evidence for executive functioning deficits, and looking to see whether this kind of training might be helpful for them as well. So relevant to this audience, I think the question is how might this kind of cognitive training approach be helpful or useful in the context of FASD? So why might we do it? I guess the first point is not news probably to anybody on this call, but individuals with FASD seem to have deficits in the executive functioning domain, and also seem to have high rates of comorbidity with things like internalizing symptoms, so anxiety, depression, often have high trauma histories or childhood adversity burden. And there seem to be links between executive functioning difficulties and other broad functional outcomes, including things like social functioning or behavioral problems. So perhaps if we're able to intervene, it might be helpful very directly by just improving the neuropsychological functioning and things like academic skills, but it might have indirect benefits as well on some of these other affective symptoms that seem to present an obstacle for optimal daily functioning. So for example, we might see that there is an impact on negative thinking patterns as we see in other disorders where people with better cognitive skills or who develop better cognitive skills are better able to downregulate those negative cognitions that are so common in mood and anxiety disorders. We might also see improvements in the ability to self-regulate, to downregulate some of those impulsive behaviors, or in the ability to cope with environmental stressors. So potentially being less reactive to stress as it arises, or better able to downregulate that reactivity once it does occur. In thinking about what the open questions are for how we might adapt to this in the case of FASD, I think the first big question in my mind is how best to enhance this to maximize the compliance and the acceptability in the population who's actually going to be using this. And this is true not just in FASD, I think, but across the board, finding ways to make it more engaging. And one of the ways that that people have done this is by essentially gamifying. So making it a video game, making it something cool that's interesting to play. And so in the case of ADHD, there's games where people incorporate eye tracking with visual attention games so that kids actually can use their eyes to play the game, and it looks like a fun jetpack instead of something that's kind of boring and dull. The second open question is how best to adapt this to the individual skill level. And this is something that, again, we're wrestling with outside of FASD as well, but we really want to make sure that we're titrating the difficulty to where the person is at. If it's too far above the skill level, it's not going to be effective, and it's also going to be frustrating and something that people don't want to do. And so currently the way that we're addressing this is really simply, we just have an algorithm that does a running tally of their accuracy and tries to go up or down based on whether they're repeatedly not hitting an 85% accuracy mark. But there's lots of other ways that you could do this as well. The third point is how best to optimize this so that there's actual clinical transfer. We don't really want people to just be better at a game. We really want people to be better at the thinking skill more broadly so they can apply it to their day-to-day life. So this is the issue of transfer. So how much do people need to get? How frequently, how much do they need to have? And do we need to do other things to help encourage that transfer in order for them to clinically receive the most benefit? And then last is how do we integrate this in the context of existing treatment frameworks? So for us currently, we're doing this in the context of cognitive behavioral therapy. In the case of FASD, the question would be how best do we integrate this with the broader treatment plan or intervention strategies that are ongoing? And I know that individuals in this group have already started doing some kind of treatment programs like the GOFAR program. And so perhaps we could think about how this is a complementary approach that kind of adds on to that metacognitive approach and brings in some of the reparative approach with the executive functioning skills. So I think that's all I have for that. I'll just say thank you and acknowledge the funding sources for this. And I'm happy to take any questions.
So it is away. It's Michael Charnas. Thank you so much, Jessica. And I have a question, which is, we would presume that the mechanisms for executive dysfunction in fetal alcohol spectrum disorders are likely different than in PTSD. Do you see this same approach working in a variety of disorders that might have differences in abnormalities in neural circuitry? You know, in the case of FASD, some of these are abnormal circuits, presumably that have been laid down during development, whereas in PTSD, people bring often to their experience a fully developed and normal nervous system then undergoes alterations in the setting of the traumatic stress. So how do you see the applicability of this approach to a developmental disorder where the circuitry may be different?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, because I think one part of it is how plastic is it once you get people into the program. So if you have a circuit that is you sort of put on a different trajectory early on, how do you then, is the process the same once they do this kind of training? So are you actually restoring the road, or are people through repeated practice, if they're getting better, are they coming up with an alternative way to get to the same endpoint? And I think that's sort of an open question and also might depend on when you intervene. So it might look different if you intervene in someone who is an adult as opposed to if you decided to do this kind of intervention earlier on in development. I will say that we do see effects in people who experience pretty chronic childhood trauma, childhood adversity, where you might expect that some of the abnormalities that developed were much earlier in the process than you might see in, for example, an adult who has a later onset traumatic event. And we see similar effects in childhood traumatic stress as opposed to adult. But I think that in the case of FASD, it really would be an open question. I think first, can you get people to have these restorative effects? And if so, is it happening in the same way or is it happening in more of a compensatory way?
And then a follow-up question, which is certainly for FASD, but also possibly for PTSD. There's some evidence that there are epigenetic changes that mediate some of the alterations in neural circuitry. Have you, in any of your work, used HDAC inhibitors, some of which are sometimes used in patients with PTSD to see if they will facilitate some of the plastic changes? Valproic acid is an example I'm thinking of.
Mm-hmm. We have not, but I think that's a really interesting question and something that we would definitely be interested in looking at.
Great, thank you. And any questions from others on the call?
I have a question. Hi, Jessica. Okay. Quick question about sort of the very interesting stuff, by the way, the paradigm in terms of repetition and sort of building on practice over a series of trials. Have you observed any different patterns in terms of the plasticity? In other words, if you hold off or you interrupt the sequence of repetitions, do you start to see decay in people's performance? Are there individual differences in terms of how additive the progress is? And then especially like if you let off the gas, do you see a decline? And does that tell you something about how the circuitry is changing?
Mm-hmm. I mean, we certainly see individual variability in responsiveness to how effective the training is. Part of that, I think, is a product of where people start. So some people have further to develop. We haven't really done a thorough investigation of this idea of kind of cut points or stopping points. So if you interrupt and you stop it at a certain point, how does that impact how people proceed over time? We also don't have very long follow-up. So that's another real open question, is how long are we actually seeing these kinds of effects? And really we were hoping that it would be sustained, and then it would be something that's sort of self-perpetuating. As people get better at it, they continue to practice in their daily life by virtue of trying to manage better. But we don't really know how long that effect is actually sustained.
Great. Any other questions?
This is Jennifer, and actually the question about how long-lasting is one that I was very interested in. But I also just have a question, recognizing that there would have to be some adaptability. All of your work to this point has been with adult populations, correct?
Yes, all with adults. Okay.
And any other questions? All right, Ed has come back just at the moment, but I want to thank you, Jessica, for a really stimulating presentation and for the work that you're doing. And I will pass the chair back to Ed. Ed, you're muted. Still muted, there you go.
All right, so I don't know if you asked, there were questions or not.
We did.
So are there any questions or did I miss that part?
No, we had some good discussion. Thanks.
Okay, all right. So we are finished with the presentation. And Jessica, I will go back and listen to it. And I think Jill may have your slides as well. So I should be able to review it. So thank you again very much, and thank Ken Jones for suggesting this topic, and I wish you all the best. I'm sorry I had to miss the end of it. He's trying to work on my hot water heater. So thank you very much. So Jessica, you can, you don't have to do this anymore. You're out of here.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you very much for your attention. It was nice to meet everyone.
Thanks, Ken, for suggesting it. Appreciate it. All right, so let's see. Jill, you got some slides to throw up, I think.
I do.
So we just have a few items of business. First one, I hope, is the progress report that is due today, I believe. Do you have one for that, Jill?
It's right here. So.
All right. Right. So we have to have the progress reports unless there's some extenuating circumstances that you can't get it in today, but please let us know when. And Jill will then put those together and send them out to the Science Advisory Board, hopefully by tomorrow, next day at the latest. All right, any questions about that? Jill, any comments about that?
You got it.
Okay, so the next thing we're trying to do is to plan the late fall 2020 progress report meeting that we're going to do by Zoom on the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th of December. Those are the times that are scheduled, and I understand that not everybody can make every time, but hopefully we arranged it so that the majority of people will be on all of the calls. So we are trying to put together the agenda for that. It'll be similar to what we've done in the past, but any ideas that you want included on the agenda, please email myself and Jill ideas for the agenda. We have to get this to NIAAA, hopefully very early next week, and start preparing your slides for 10 minutes. And then 5 minutes of question and answers. And we're basically interested in what new findings you have, what items have been delivered, how COVID is impacting your research, and then future plans for the remainder of the year 4, year 5, and perhaps just a sentence or two of what you may be planning for any potential RFA that comes out asking for a CFAS 5. Anything I missed, Jill?
You got it.
Okay, here is the just a reminder that on November 30th, NIAAA is going to start its 50th anniversary science symposium. There are quite a number of very good discussions, many by people we all know, you know, and even have some relationship at one point to at least hear people at UCSD. But the big talk is Mike Charnas. It's going to be on the first, on day two at 3:20, where Michael is going to talk about awareness insights in 50 years on fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. And I know Michael is planning on highlighting some of the findings from CFAS in that. So
Ed, I can say the talk was pre-recorded. It's done. I can't tell you what I said because I hadn't slept much the night before, but most of the talk was about CFAS.
Okay, so it would be a great idea for everybody to participate in this video cast. And so were all the talks pre-recorded?
Yes, they were, so that we didn't have Zoom moments.
Okay. All right. Bill, any comments on that?
No, this is the first time I actually have seen the agenda myself. You know, ideally we would have had this in person a few months ago. And I'm glad that we're still able to do it remotely. And, you know, I would encourage folks to join when they can, and especially for Michael's talk.
Yeah, I would encourage them to join even if they don't watch the whole thing, just so that their name gets shown up on the attendance list. So
I don't know if anyone's taken attendance, but
they record everything. Come on, it's the government. So
it all goes to Homeland Security, right?
Absolutely, but we never know who the head of Homeland Security will be. So could change daily here. All right, so let's see, email revised abstracts for Michael's Charnas. He needs the abstracts for the ISPR symposium, RSA ISPR symposium, that's been rescheduled for June 2021, hopefully. And hopefully by then, this whole pandemic thing will be done. So that's that. Jill, anything else?
That's all I've got.
That is it, huh? All right. So, Leah, data access, any committee updates there?
One request was recently received and actually approved about a week or so ago. And Tina has someone who's helping pull out data from dysmorphology, and Julie Cable got some data. It's the Ukraine data. She wanted to look at heart rate and heart rate and alcohol exposure timing and frequency.
Okay.
That's exciting.
That is. That's good. So I think we're doing well getting stuff out. Sarah's not on the call.
I can share her update.
Please do.
So there were no concept proposals or manuscript submissions as of yesterday in the forms, but there was one post-acceptance form, and it's a not even linkable yet publication from Wozniak's group on the hippocampal subfield abnormalities and memory functioning in children with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. And that's going to appear in Neurotoxicology and Teratology. And the message that can be tweeted out about it is that discrete brain abnormalities associated with memory functioning identified in children with prenatal alcohol exposure. So congratulations to Jeff and that group. And just a reminder to fill out the Google Forms as you think of ideas through when they're published.
So I'm very pleased about that. I think, how many were there this year since June, Jill? Do you remember 32 or something?
I know a lot of numbers are in my head right now, and I'm not sure which are which, so I can't say for sure. But along the same breath, because he'll never say it himself, Ed reached a milestone in that he has now been the author on 300 publications.
Ooh, hotsy-totsy.
And CFAS is just one behind him. We're at 299.
What can I say? Thank you, Jill. I've been saying I've had 300 for the last year, but.
Busted.
Yeah, well, some of them were just technical reports, not peer reviewed, so it's all right. The 300 are peer reviewed, I think, so. All right, so let's see, what else? All right, are there any really exciting data that anyone has that they've recently collected or would like to let everybody know about? No? All right.
I will just share, because it's very preliminary, that Olivia Weeks, who is now focusing on heart disease in adults with FASD, and still using the zebrafish model, is finding things quite similar to what Claire did, but in a model or using actual chart review rather than patient report. So reassuring, I wouldn't call it replication, but hint that Claire and Therese and Joanne are all on the right path with this, and that different methods for eliciting this data may be producing convergent findings. So we'll hear more about that, I hope, in the future.
And I'm assuming that any word on the UH2s joining CFAS will be within the next couple of weeks?
I think that's a good assumption. We are making some progress, but I really can't give an update at this time, Ed.
No, I didn't expect one. I got asked the question yesterday or today or the day before, and I thought I've heard maybe December 1st.
Yeah, I think we'll know more at the end of this week.
All right, good. And yep. I think we're all interested in who might be joining CFest. All right, so any other hot data anyone needs to talk about? Tom, how are things going at NOFAS? It's been a while since we've heard from you, if you're there. Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm here. Sorry, I started talking before I unmuted. Thank you, Ed. Things are going well at NOFAS. We are excited to be, not really related to our education work with CFAS, but making a lot of progress with some policy folks. And I hope that you all seem, you know, to feel the same way about just increasing number of we see, whether it's families or clinical settings, all the research you're doing where the issue is being addressed. So we really feel like there's been maybe not quite a surge, but increase in attention. And for so many reasons, you're frustrated with COVID, but had made some good progress, and that sort of set aside some of the work in Washington when it comes to FASD. But we have a new website in the works, a new podcast that's starting. So excited about a lot of things.
I will make an unsolicited plug that I think it's still possible that if people contribute to NOFAS, they're contribution is doubled by somebody. Is that true?
Yeah, by you, Ed. Yes. That is true. Thank you for putting in that plug. Absolutely. We have a couple of people who've stepped forward to offer to match the first 30,000 that NOFAS raises as we started a campaign on FASD Awareness Day. And we've raised about 17,000-18,000 so far. And this is all money from families, from advocates, all low dollar donations. So go to nofas.org. And we also have a little exercise tumbler, if you call it, that with the NOFAS logo, we want to send to everyone who donates. So even a small few dollars is helpful. Thank you.
All right. Any comments from the Science Advisory Board?
I think that's just me today, Ed. You've already answered two of my questions, which were about the progress reports and what we know about the UH2s. There was a third question. I did talk with John yesterday. John organized a...
John on, I believe.
Sorry?
John is on.
Oh, is he
I
on?
I am. I am. Yep.
Oh, okay. Well, we had talked about... John had organized a... symposium a couple years ago that involved CFAS and several other centers, and I didn't know if there was an effort underway to try to do the same thing for 2021 yet or not. And so I just wanted to raise that up because I've been away for a few months and I'm still catching up on things.
I don't believe there's an effort, and I think one of the issues this year is going to be, since many of the symposium proposed and accepted for last year's meeting will be at this year's meeting, that time and space will probably add a premium for the RSA meeting.
Okay.
If it's live.
All right.
Michael, any comments that you have about it, or anyone on the program committee? No.
No. No, it's Joanne. So I was involved in chairing that. John was instrumental in the idea and in moving it forward. And the central theme we had was around the idea of inflammation, and tapped across centers where there were studies involving immune system and inflammation. But there are lots of other themes that could be picked up and do a similar thing. So hopefully, if not for this year, maybe for next year, we could do something like that again.
It's a great idea, and I think we should do it again. I'm just wondering if next year, given the fact that it's a joint ISBRA RSA meeting and everything is being held over, I'm sure that the program committee is going to be very tight about what's put in there.
Yeah.
But maybe several of us can stay in communication about that and look ahead for next year. Okay.
Absolutely. I encourage it. John, so that's your charge.
Okay.
All right.
We'll keep in touch.
Bill, comments, concerns, questions, insights?
Well, just a couple things. So yesterday we had a meeting, our two-day meeting for the HBCD study. It's the Healthy Brain and Child Development study that several institutes are funding at NIH. And George Kub was on the call, gave some opening remarks. And I know Claire and Michael were there as well. But one of the things he mentioned, and I'm not sure if everyone had seen this publication in JAMA Network Open, I think it was published maybe a month or two ago, reporting on the increase of drinking during the pandemic. And, you know, I think the take-home message from that publication for CFAS is that it appears that women are drinking even more frequently. I think the number is up to about 17% compared to last year. And if you look at heavy drinking, binge drinking, it's up over 40% during the pandemic. So NIAAA is continuing to fund surveys to kind of get a better sense for what the pandemic is meaning in terms of alcohol consumption. But it does raise concerns that there's going to be a dramatic increase in pregnancies exposed to alcohol here in the future. So I don't have to tell you guys that, but it's a message that the Institute is trying to get out there to the public. Other issues, I will say in terms of the face-to-face meeting, I'm not sure if George Kub will make the meeting. He'll be invited, but I would encourage everyone to take their update talks seriously. I think it'll be important for us to see the progress that each other is making given the COVID delays. But I think it'll also be important for NIAAA to get a collective sense of where CFAS 4 stands. So I did want to, at least get that out there.
In those overviews, do you want budgetary issues raised in terms of how COVID has impacted individual projects in terms of?
No, I don't think we need to get into that, into, budget issues, but I would say be realistic in terms of where you're at, in terms of delays, in terms of progress, and I guess be honest with each other in terms of whether we'll be able to get to the finish line at the same time for CFAS 4.
I mean, Joe's not on the call, so we have about 12, 13 minutes left. So anybody have any concerns or issues or things that they're worried about here or CFAS related issues? If not, I know there are a number of people who have another Zoom call today, and probably almost everybody. So have a great one, and everyone stay safe and keep healthy. All right. Bye.
Bye, all.
Bye.
Bye.